You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of April, 2017, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, Washington's growing list of foreign enemies. US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson uses a rare press conference to criticize Iran. Then we turn to France as campaigning enters the final stretch ahead of the first round of the presidential elections. Also ahead, what's next for Fox News after Bill O'Reilly's departure? Plus, why Denmark now wants to attract more migrants. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guest today, Geoffrey Howard, who's a lecturer in political theory at University College London, and Robin Lustig, who's a journalist and broadcaster and the former presenter of The World Tonight on BBC Radio 4. Welcome both back to Midori House. Now we're going to start today's programme in Iran. The deal in 2015 to curb the nation's nuclear weapons programme was the culmination of concerted efforts by Barack Obama to engage the Islamic Republic. But yesterday, US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson hit out at Iran in a rare press conference that marked a dramatic change in tone. He accused Iran of supporting terrorists, violating human rights, and being a destabilizing force. Robin, I say it's a change of tone. I guess we've heard all this on the campaign trail from Mr. Trump's team. They've said from the beginning it was a very bad deal. Is this just them coming good on their promise and what we should have expected?
Well, I think there are a number of interesting things. First of all, Mr. Tillerson doesn't say a great deal in public, so when he does speak in public, people pay a lot of attention to him. What he said, you're right, wasn't that different to what Donald Trump used to say on the campaign trail, but it comes on the heels of a finding that Iran has in fact fulfilled all its obligations under that agreement that was signed with the Obama administration. It's quite difficult, therefore, for the US administration to say, we're going to tear it up. I mean, it's quite something if the US decides unilaterally to tear up a solemn agreement that it has signed with another country when that other country is fulfilling all its obligations. For Mr. Tillerson to call Iran a state sponsor of terrorism, which indeed it has been in various places. I'm not a great defender of Iran, I have to say. Its human rights record is absolutely appalling. Nevertheless, this is a man who's just been in Saudi Arabia, whose human rights record is probably even worse, and who arguably have been an even greater state sponsor of terrorism, at least in the past. He seems to be talking with one eye shut, if that's a physical possibility.
So, just before we move on, the 90-day review, in which he says he's going to look at everything, he doesn't say he's going to pull apart the nuclear deal, though, does he? We're not quite sure what this review is going to look for.
A lot of it, obviously, is to do with sanctions. Iran wants more sanctions to be lifted. It would be embarrassing for the Trump administration to do that, given everything that Donald Trump said during the campaign. The other thing that one has to really bear in mind is that there are elections coming up in Iran. And if the hardliners in Iran, who weren't very keen on this deal either, have any reason to say to voters, look, you can't trust the Americans. They speak with forked tongue. They negotiated in bad faith. They're intending to tear up the agreement. That might play quite well with certain Iranian voters and up the ante even more. I think it's a very dangerous path.
Geoffrey, the other dangerous thing about the path, which is intriguing, is if they were going to have any negotiations with the North Koreans, here you'd fear this could fall apart as well. Because if you were going to North Korea and saying, okay, we'll agree a deal with you over your nuclear program, and then you get the sense that they might come back months later and say, oh, we've changed our mind, we're not going to stick to that deal, It has ramifications beyond Iran, doesn't it?
I think that's right. I mean, I think the credibility of the United States of America's word is on the line here. And intriguingly, Donald Trump even recognized this during the campaign, indicating at one point quite early on that, well, when the U.S. stands behind something, when it makes a deal, you have to live up to it. And of course, later on during the campaign, he said that very early on in his presidency, he'd rip up the deal. But now here we are, and he hasn't ripped up the deal. And even Secretary of State Tillerson hasn't suggested that they're going to rip up the deal. They're just undertaking a review to see that about whether they might add extra conditions. Now, this is quite striking in a multilateral agreement. How is it that one party can just unilaterally add conditions to the deal? So one possible outcome from this is that the United States will simply be left behind as the rest of the world just goes along with the agreement as written. But it might even have worse consequences. It might have the consequence of Iran deciding if should Rouhani lose the election on May 19th, deciding for him, should Rouhani lose the election and the hardliners win, the hardliners might start saying, fine, we'll unilaterally start adding conditions to the deal, and the whole thing could just blow up in smoke. I mean, I think that Donald Trump is really hedging his bets here. He doesn't quite know what to make of the deal. And if it turns out that the hardliners win the election in Iran and end up tearing up the deal themselves, he says, well, I never supported it anyway.
I suppose if you wanted to be really optimistic, you could say that he's looking for a way out. He's looking for a way back from what he said during the campaign. And the 90-day review is always one of the favorite tricks of any government, isn't it? Kick it into the long grass, hope people forget, something will come along, we don't have to make a decision yet.
And Jeffrey, do you think he could be helping the hardliners here in a way? Because, you know, if you're seen as, you know, as Robin was saying, if you're seen as attacking, you know, a moderate, in inverted commas, president in Rouhani, it could embolden the voters who think, actually, okay, Rouhani's not going to get the deal we want. We now have to go back to a more hardline, you know, theocratic candidate to get what we need out of this situation.
I think that's right. I think you could imagine a scenario in which the Trump administration was having backdoor talks with Iran saying, listen, we're going to apply some added pressure to you, Rouhani. The government, the economy in Iran isn't doing particularly well. There's lots of unemployment. People want their government to be able to say to them, look, we've gotten some sanctions lifted. There's going to be some economic relief. And Rouhani's going to be in trouble if they're not able to say that. Now, what conditions they might be pressing Rouhani on behind the scenes is less clear. What is clear, though, is that the Trump administration is taking a really risky gamble here. A cynic might think that the more Bannonite wing of the Trump administration is actually desiring conflict with Iran, that thinks that the world has returned to its natural state if the hardliners are in control of Iran. And of course, there are many people in the U.S. government, probably on both sides of the aisle, who think that we never should have engaged in this deal to begin with, that Iran has always been our enemy, and that even though they say that we'll have access to the facilities to inspect the nuclear programs, they're not. They're going to call our bluff. They're going to cheat their way through it, just like North Korea's done. So I think there's a real possibility here that the hardliners will be empowered as a result of all this.
And Robin, there's a feeling that, you know, obviously Donald Trump has a close relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu. He's also, you know, more likely to give countenance to what the Saudis want. You know, not only does he not criticize them, you know, they have a real desire to see some action taken against Iranian power within the region. Do you think that that is part of this as well?
Yes, I do, very much so. I mean, I think when the history books come to be written, there will be one chapter at least on the Obama administration's success in preventing Israel from having bombed Iran and having saved a conflagration in the Middle East. That's one of the things that this agreement did. It is true, I think, that the Trump administration is much closer to Israel than the Obama administration. It's also, of course, much closer to Saudi Arabia. And although Israel and Saudi don't see eye to eye about a lot of things, they do see eye to eye about Iran. They both regard Iran as a hugely dangerous and destabilizing influence and a threat to their own regional power in the area. So, yes, I think that is very much part of what's going on.
And Jeffrey, finally on this topic, do you think we're seeing the emergence of a more coherent, successful foreign policy, though, apart from our questions about this issue from the US administration? It's interesting that Donald Trump seems to have had certain kind of fillips in the polls from his foreign policy, you know, his grit and his determination. The tough guy thing seems to be playing with a certain constituency much better than the last few months.
if there is such a thing as a Trump doctrine, they're being very coy about what exactly it involves. There he goes talking for months and months and months about isolationism, about America first, about not getting entangled with misadventures abroad. And then, by all accounts, he sees the truly horrifying photos of the chemical attack in Syria and is moved to intervene. He engages in discussion with radio hosts and TV hosts, where by all accounts he changes his mind in the middle of these interviews, and his staff has to go picking up the pieces. And of course, we're getting subtly different messages from Tillerson, from Secretary of State Mattis, from H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, from Pence, from Trump himself. There isn't quite a unified message. Now, underneath, this might be a calculated muddle. This might be an attempt to sow a certain kind of confusion that throws Beijing and possibly Pyongyang off. And there might be some good realpolitik sense in that. But whether it's just a muddle or a calculated muddle, I think remains to be seen.
Well, we're going to move on now to France. As the race for the Élysée enters its final stage, this Sunday, voters will cast their ballots on the first round of the presidential elections in a vote that's been widely seen as a barometer of the EU's future. Do you think that's a fair test? You know, because it's quite hard to read what's going on in France, and it feels very particular, oddly, to France at this time.
It is very particular to France, and their system of electing their president is very particular as well. This first round, which has lots of candidates, and then only the top two go through to the second round. But I think, like all elections, this is about a lot of different things. Obviously, those of us outside France look at the future of the EU as perhaps one of the most important things. I think for French voters, though, there are many other considerations. The French economy has been in a pretty dire state for a long time. French unemployment is extremely high. There are great tensions in the city suburbs outside Paris and other major cities. They have had some terrible terrorist attacks. There's a lot going on in France. It is going through a very difficult time. The François Hollande era has not been a happy one. He's had abysmal ratings now for several years, which is why, of course, he decided not to stand again. And the prospect is, which I suspect is giving a lot of people, at least in Brussels, nightmares, that the two candidates who go through to the second round might both be, to use the shorthand, anti-EU. Marine Le Pen on the right and Jean-Luc Mélenchon on the left. Neither of them could be regarded as friends of the EU. So if that is indeed what happens, personally, I don't think it will. But if it does, then that's very bad news for the EU.
Jeffrey, do you think we're seeing a fracturing of the French state? Because as Robin was saying, what's interesting, Mélenchon on the left has suddenly kind of risen up the polls, seems to be finding an audience that we didn't even realise were there, even like 6, 7, 8 weeks ago. Macron is doing pretty well as a centrist candidate. And then on the right, we have Marine Le Pen. It feels that there are kind of three different Frances roughly divided into equal parts.
I think that global forces are shaking up the political chessboard in France, just like they've shaken up the political chessboard in the UK and in the US and in countries around the world. The old dichotomy of left versus right no longer is quite as relevant as it used to be. The Economist this week mentions that the battle over liberal internationalism has moved to the cradle of the Enlightenment, which I think is a quite nice way of putting it. If you wind up with an election where you have Le Pen versus Macron, you will really have this new dichotomy between the parochial nativist nationalist forces on the one hand and the open multicultural cosmopolitan forces on the other hand. There's been lots of controversy over David Goodhart's new book, in which he paints the picture of a group of people who he calls the somewheres, people who feel rooted in a particular place, feel connected to a particular national identity and are hostile to forces that threaten that identity, and the anywheres, people who welcome free trade and free movement of people as winds at their backs that help them live better and more prosperous lives. And I think France is really turning out to be a microcosm of the world at large here.
There is a huge anti-elite mood swinging across the liberal democracies. I mean, I think it's a large part of why Donald Trump won in the US. It's a large part of why the Brexit side won in the UK referendum. We will see whether it's as strong in France as it has been elsewhere. We should bear in mind that it's not universal. In the Netherlands, for example, the elite emerged okay, just about. And in Austria, it wasn't the far-right candidate in their presidential elections a few months ago who came through, although it was a close-run thing. There is an anti-elite mood. I think a lot of it springs back from the financial crisis of 2008, since when vast numbers of people have seen their own economic well-being stymied. They either have been worse off or certainly no better off, and they blame the people who were in charge, the politicians, the financiers, the bankers, all the usual culprits, and they're going to vote accordingly.
Robin, before we came on air, we were beginning to have a bit of a discussion about British politics. Now, when you look at the UK's impending election, I guess the most populist party, and what they say is UKIP, who currently have one MP who's standing down and was rejoining the Tories.
Well, he's left the party anyway.
Who's now going to stand down. It's unclear whether they will get enough votes anywhere to have any more MPs. But on the left, I guess, trying to embrace some of those sentiments of populism is Jeremy Corbyn.
Oh, definitely, yes. Listening to him this morning, he very much was speaking as if he were a British Bernie Sanders or a British Pepe Grillo or a British Jean-Luc Mélenchon, casting himself as the champion of the little people against the establishment, the outsider, the man who tears up the rules, very much wanting to portray himself in that mould. The fact that he's been an MP for over 30 years and comes from one of the most elite parts of London is all by the by. But that is certainly, it seems to be, the mood which he is hoping
but
to
capture. But do you think he could ride that same wave that Mélenchon is riding?
Well, we'll see. I mean, first of all, we'll see how well Mélenchon does in France on Sunday. All the suggestions in the UK are that Mr. Corbyn is not regarded by most British voters as a credible alternative prime minister. He just doesn't look or sound like what people think a prime minister should look or sound like. The Labour Party has been through a very, very difficult period now for many years. The whole Blair-Brown legacy still hangs heavily on their shoulders. I don't think that Mr. Corbyn is going to do terribly well, but if we've learned one thing over the last couple of years, it's to be extremely sceptical of what the opinion polls tell us.
Geoffrey, you sit as an outsider insider here in the UK. You know, we don't want to divert ourselves solely into the UK election. But again, when you look at the lineup of candidates, are you surprised that it seems a much more traditional election in what the media are currently saying? They feel that it's going to be a coronation for Theresa May, with a huge majority and perhaps something of the size that Thatcher had back in her day. Are you surprised that at the moment, even though we have these potential risings of populism, that the UK seems a more traditional election as against France or against the US, for example?
I think it's genuinely puzzling that there is this startling incongruence between the political upheaval that generated Brexit and the familiarity and almost tranquility of the upcoming election, where everyone is accepting that it's going to be a conservative blowout, and the only bit of drama seems to be, well, just how badly will Labour do, and just how many seats, 7, 8, 9, maybe 10, will the Lib Dems pick up? But other than that, there's no real controversy. And quite frankly, I'm a bit more surprised that there's not more chaos inside the Labour Party with people trying to dethrone Corbyn, trying to come up with a viable alternative before the election, which looks almost certain like it's not going to happen.
I think part of the explanation for that is the electoral system that we have in the UK. Under a first-past-the-post system, it is extraordinarily difficult for an outside party to break through. If we had a fair voting system in this country, UKIP would have had nearly 100 seats after the last election based on their percentage of the electorate who voted for them. But they didn't. They got one MP. It wasn't fair. They should have had more, as I say, if there'd been a fair representation of their support. It's really, really difficult. Back in the early 1980s, there was a breakaway party from the Labour Party, the Social Democratic Party. They looked extremely good in the opinion polls. They something like 25% of the vote at one point. It gave them virtually no MPs. It's really hard.
We have another story we need to move on to, but to either of you, or to both of you, do you find it funny that, maybe Robin, you can pick this up first, you know, when you look back at, say, France in the 60s or France in the 70s even with the Labour movement there, these times, are they really as tumultuous as we we're presenting them. Perhaps we had a nice kind of like soppy bit in the 90s and the 2000s where there was seemed to be plenty of wealth and everyone was kind of moving into middling ground. But actually, isn't this just France as normal in a way?
Well, it's calmer than it was actually in the 60s. I mean, in the 1960s, France almost had a new revolution on the streets. Charles de Gaulle was planning to leave the country at one point. What I think you have, though, is a new political system. You no longer have organized labor and extremely powerful trade unions. The what used to be called the working class no longer exists as a cohesive political force in the way that it did. It's far more disparate. People don't belong to tribes in the same way, perhaps, as they used to. It's very much more difficult, therefore, for politicians to know where to go for their support, and it's very much more difficult for pundits like us to try to make sense of what's going on.
And Geoffrey, for you, when you look at the elections and the times we're in, do you think it's a time of, you know, political earthquakes or more tremors, really?
I think it's really hard to get perspective on all this, which is a bit ironic coming from someone who's an academic philosopher, but it's true. And I think, of course, politics is a high-stakes business, and whether or not the tumult of the day is equivalent on the political Richter scale to the tumult of 20 years ago, it feels really important to us what's going on, and so it's natural for us to care. I think it's all relative, and so in a way, it doesn't really make a difference whether we're in a new era of greater tumult than before or whether we're not. It's high stakes all the same.
Well, you're listening to Midori House, and it's certainly high stakes here with me, Andrew Tuck, Geoffrey Howard, and Robin Lustig, and we're going to be right back after this.
Hello, I'm Steve Bloomfield, and I want to tell you about an exciting event we've got coming up. On the 11th of May, we'll open the doors of Midori House here in London for a special episode of The Foreign Desk with a live audience. Up for discussion, the French election.
The problem is, they've got to have somebody to vote for, and the choice will be between the National Front and a Conservative candidate. But this is where the implosion of the left really is, I think, the tragedy for France at the moment.
With an expert panel of guests, including journalist and author Jonathan Fenby and the AFP's London Bureau Chief Florence Biedermann, we'll ask not only what the election could mean for the future of France, but also for Europe in the age of rising populism.
She presents herself as a kind of Jeanne d'Arc in a way, you know, like a national heroine who defends the country. But in what she doesn't say, she eliminates so many things.
We'll have the results. We've got the panel. All we need now is you. If you'd like to be in the audience, head to monocle.com to get your tickets today. That's The Foreign Desk Live on Thursday, the 11th of May at 1900 with me, Steve Bloomfield.
Welcome back to Midori House, and still with me are Geoffrey Howard and Robin Lustig. Off to the US now, where Fox News' star presenter and biggest moneymaker, Bill O'Reilly, has been forced off the network that made him famous. O'Reilly has faced numerous allegations of sexual harassment, and this week Fox executives decided to pull him from his show. Geoffrey, perhaps you could just explain to outsiders who don't watch Fox every single night, not saying that you do, the significance of this man and his career and why, in a way, that Fox backed him for so long.
Sure. Bill O'Reilly's a household name in the United States. He's the highest rated, most watched cable news primetime anchor. Calling him an anchor suggests that he's straightforwardly reporting journalism, but that's not straightforwardly reporting the news, but that's not quite what he's done. And I think, you know, he's really inaugurated a brand of nighttime news station programming whereby you intersperse news reporting with moral and political judgment. He tells you what's happened in the day's news, and he tells you what to think about it. And he does so in a quite brash, authentic, sometimes bullying way that I think appeals to a lot of people. And he's not afraid of calling people out for political correctness. And indeed, I think a lot of the things that make people attracted to Donald Trump also explain why people have been attracted to Bill O'Reilly. He doesn't talk nonsense. He tells you what he thinks. He's very authentic, even at the risk of offending a lot of his guests. And so it comes as a shock, I bet, to a lot of his viewers that there have been complaints pouring in about his alleged sexual harassment that have ultimately led to the Murdochs sacking him yesterday.
Now, why was he sacked, Robin, do you think? Because advertisers were deserting the show?
Yeah, absolutely. One word, money. You described him as Fox's biggest moneymaker. He turned into Fox's biggest money loser. The advertisers ran away from him once it became known that Fox had been paying off millions and millions.
$13 million, yeah.
Huge amounts of money over a period of many, many years, because there were so many complaints from fellow employees, women, who were making allegations against him, and they were buying silence with millions and millions of dollars. Once that became known, and once Fox, it would appear from the statement that was put out yesterday by Rupert Murdoch, made their own inquiries and concluded, it would seem, that there was no way in which they could continue to defend this man, they cut him loose. It reminded me very much of the decision that Murdoch made to close the News of the World, the British Sunday paper, which was at the centre of phone hacking allegations some years ago. That decision was made because it was tarnishing the brand. The advertisers were deserting it. It was bad for the brand. At the moment, the Murdoch clan are trying to buy the remainder of Sky Television here in the UK. They own quite a lot of it already. They want to buy the rest of it. They need to get government approval for that. If they are seen to be tarnished by the O'Reilly scandal, then obviously it becomes much less likely. It's all down to money with Murdoch.
Jeffrey, what do you think is going to happen? So Fox News has, you know, now let go an anchor that may be bad for advertisers, but I was looking at the ratings. His ratings have been going up, you know, continuously over the recent months. More and more people have been watching the show despite all the scandal, perhaps because of the scandal. His book publisher said, you know, we're not walking away from a deal with him. He's going to sell more books. We think he's, you know, we're confident about backing him. For his constituency, a little bit like Mr. Trump, when Mr. Trump was caught out claiming that he was going to grab women by whatever. And then, you know, I saw women holding up placards saying he's welcome to grab me by the same spot. So there is a constituency of women who similarly don't give a damn, who like that kind of man. So do you think that it's going to be difficult for Fox News if it tries to paint itself as a, you know, a cleaner, serener, you know, more middle of the road broadcaster? Are they going to lose people who will go to other channels where they can find their TV equivalent of the shock jock?
It's quite possible. I mean, it was so striking in Murdoch's statement that he released yesterday, where he wrote that despite all his indiscretions, Bill O'Reilly is one of the most accomplished TV personalities in the history of cable news. He was praising him in the very statement that he was releasing him. And perhaps this was a nod to that precise constituency, that group of people that really liked Bill O'Reilly, and that the Murdochs now are going to worry that they're going to start tuning out of Fox News. Perhaps Fox News will face allegations now that they've caved too quickly, that they should have stood by their man, as it were. Tucker Carlson is a very popular person who will be replacing the O'Reilly factor on the vaunted 8 p.m. slot. And so I think they'll still have very good ratings. But I think that Fox News is going to be in trouble over this one. Now, they did the right thing for the wrong reason. They should have been morally motivated to do it. Money shouldn't have had to do it. But given how long it took them and how much they were dragging their feet and how much money, $13 million, they paid off, it was pretty clear that if this is going to be called moral progress, it's a very tepid, incremental kind of moral progress. We are not making progress in our major institutions when it comes to combating sexual harassment.
Sorry to interrupt you, but no, it's interesting, though, isn't it, that corporate America seems to have a higher sense of morality almost than either political or media America. It was the fact that advertisers did not want to be seen near this man once the allegations became public that did for him. And the fact that that is the calculation that they make, I find quite interesting. It could be that corporate America is actually more in tune with more of public opinion than sometimes they're given credit for.
And I think that's progress.
Yeah, sure. Except if you work for a tech company on the West Coast, where you might be surprised that there's similar levels of kind of sexism and God knows what. But anyway, we have one more story to peek in here at the end very quickly. Denmark, well, the Nordic nation has been one of the most closed off for migrants for some time now. But the finance ministry is now walking back on years of government policy and trying to make the case for more foreign workers. And after some number crunching, they reach a simple conclusion. Even the lowest paid of full-time jobs is enough to turn an unskilled refugee into a friend of the tax office. Talking about cash and is this just another tale, Jeffrey, of, you know, governments and institutions just moving towards the money?
I mean, the public debate in Denmark has been about how much money immigrants are costing the government. And this research that's come out by the government is quite intriguing because it shows that certainly skilled migrants from Western Europe who can come into Denmark and start working right away benefit the economy. And if migrants from other societies could be trained up relatively quickly and get jobs relatively quickly, they too would be a boon for the economy. Even so, Mette Frederiksen, who's the leader of the Social Democratic Party, probably on track to become Denmark's next prime minister after the elections, which will happen at the latest in 2019, she is moving to the right on immigration policy. And there's a familiar idea here, which is that you can only secure the kind of political support for the welfare state that you need if there's a sense of national identity, if there's a sense that everyone's chipping in and working together. And having a bunch of people on jobs training programs as refugees need to engage in, as low-skilled migrants need to engage in, collecting welfare payments for a couple years while they tool up or educate up to be ready to join the workforce, that's very, very bad for national solidarity.
Robin, do you want to dive in?
Well, I was going to say that when I read this analysis, this Danish analysis, I did have a sense of weariness, because it has been established again and again and again by study after study after study that immigration is good for the economy, generally speaking. That's not really the issue for those voters who are unhappy about immigration. They're unhappy about other things. They're unhappy about the way in which their neighborhood is changing. They are unhappy about seeing people among them who they don't feel immediately close to, who perhaps speak a language they don't understand. They're unhappy about things which are not to do with the economy. And I think if the Danish government thinks that by publishing a study of this kind, they can persuade people to think more kindly about immigrants, they may be in for a shock.
Yeah, here in the UK, I saw someone the other day commenting on Theresa May saying that maybe migration would have to say hi. And on the note underneath of some random person said, I don't care if the pound drops to 50 pence as long as we stop these people coming. They don't care about the economy in the end.
Exactly.
Well, Jeffrey Howard and Robin Lustig, thank you so much for joining us here on Midori House. That's all we have time for today. The show was produced by Carlotta Rebello, is researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and also by Alexis Sogol. And our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. There's more music next with Nolan Giles. Then it's The Urbanist. I think that's with me. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Andrew Tuck, goodbye.